I got, for the first time, a good look at the cat's eyes peering at us. They were the first beautiful thing I ever noticed about him. They were a soft and lovely and radiant green. That's a quote from The Cat Who Came for Christmas by Cleveland Amory, born September 2, 1917, died October 14, 1998. Welcome to the Literary Catcast, dedicated to the preservation of books and writings with cats as main characters, bringing their awareness into the modern form of a podcast. Before we go further, I want to tell you there's nothing wrong with your audio. What you just heard is the purring sound of cat Louie Blue Eyes. He's our foster, and he's a Christmas cat. I talk about him at the end of the episode. He will be purring the transitions during this show. This episode is taken from one of the most beautiful books I have ever read. Amory wrote The Cat Who Came for Christmas in 1987 about his adventure rescuing a stray, hurt, starving white cat from a Manhattan alley on a snowy, cold Christmas Eve in 1977. This book spent 12 weeks at number one on the New York Times bestseller list. I have links where you may find it for purchase in this episode section on the literarycatcast.com website. Before we start into the history of this book and the reading, I want to say that this book has special meaning to me. I saw Mr. Amory on the Today Show when he was on his publicity tour for this book. I was so moved by his story that I rushed to the bookstore that morning to pick up a copy. You see, a few years before, a stray cat showed up at my apartment door during a 5 a.m. thunderstorm. I was just out of college and having a rough time in my life and was trying to figure out a painless, easy, not messy, efficient way to kill myself. This cat made a commotion at my door, waking me. I opened the door to find this mess of a scrawny cat standing there. He walked in like he was home, and by doing so, he turned my life around. I named him Simon. He gave me purpose, and he was so pathetically thin, he needed me to help him. I wrote about this event on my blog in a story titled, Saved by a Cat. It will also be linked on this episode section of the Literary Catcast website. Cleveland Amory was an author, critic, commentator, and animal rights activist. His life made the world a better place. I encourage anyone listening to this to Google and read more about him, because he was very special. Amory graduated Harvard in 1939. He was the youngest editor ever hired by the Saturday Evening Post. He left that position to work in military intelligence for the U.S. Army during the Second World War. Around 1945, he witnessed a bullfight in Nogales, Mexico, which influenced him to become an animal rights activist. He had a long career as a reporter and writer for national magazines and as a television and radio commentator. He was a regular columnist for the Saturday Review and TV Guide. He was a commentator during the beginning years of the Today Show in the early 1950s, where he began to voice his opinions on hunting, eventually getting fired for those commentaries. His novels ranged from social history books starting with The Proper Bostonians, 1947, and continuing through The Last Resorts, 1952, and Who Killed Society, 1960. These books satirized the pretensions of the upper-class society, particularly in Boston. He became popular with his best-selling novels. There are three of them about his adopted cat, Polar Bear, featured in this podcast episode. With all this success in his career, his most important work was done for animals. And I want to emphasize the word for animals. In 1967, Amory founded the Fund for Animals with a planned focus on protecting animals from hunters and creating animal sanctuaries. The fund struggled during the first years of its existence, but became known in 1979 for sponsoring a removal by air and land of 577 Grand Canyon burrows slated for destruction by the National Park Service. Inspired by Anna Sewell's novel Black Beauty, Amory established the Black Beauty Ranch, a 1,460-acre sanctuary that sheltered various abused animals, including chimpanzees, burros, and elephants. Located in Murchison, Texas, this ranch accommodated over 600 resident animals. Amory's goal when creating the animal refuge was to create a sanctuary where its inhabitants would roam unfettered and unbothered by human taskmasters. The words on the ranch's gate are taken from the final lines of Sewell's novel, "I have nothing to fear, and my story ends. My troubles are all over, and I am at home." The ranch is located very close to Dallas, Texas, in Murchison, Texas, about an hour and a half east near Tyler, Texas, and close to where I was born and raised in East Texas. I will be moving back to that area in early 2022 to live deep in the beauty of the wooded tall pines. Black Beauty Ranch is available for tours, so you can contact them. The cat in this podcast, Polar Bear, is buried there. In a very touching and appropriate end, Cleveland's ashes were placed in a pierced urn around the neck of his favorite donkey named Friendly. Friendly then scattered his ashes around the sanctuary as she walked about. A grave marker for Cleveland is placed on the Black Beauty Ranch in Murchison alongside the grave of his cat, Polar Bear. Friendly was the last surviving donkey from the original 577 burros that were rescued from the Grand Canyon in 1979. She passed away in 2011 at 36 years old. Most of this information is taken from his Wikipedia. I do want to encourage you to read more about his amazing work. And now, it's time for the CatCast. This is the first chapter in The Cat Who Came for Christmas, about the capture of Polar Bear. And remember to check our website for links to this book. It's written in Cleveland's voice, so try to imagine a man's voice as I read the story. And now, I can hear my tea kettle, and a few cats are cozied around me. Chapter 1, The Rescue. To anyone who has ever been owned by a cat, it will come as no surprise that there are all sorts of things about your cat that you will never, as long as you live, forget. Not the least of these is your first sight of him or her. That my first sight of mine, however, would ever be memorable seemed at the time highly improbable. For one thing, I could hardly see him at all. It was snowing, and he was standing some distance from me in a New York City alley. For another thing, what I did see of him was extremely unprepossessing. He was thin, and he was dirty, and he was hurt. The irony is that everything around him, except him, was beautiful. It was Christmas Eve. And although no one outside of New York would believe it on a bet or a Bible, New York City can, when it puts its mind to it, be beautiful. And that Christmas Eve, some years ago, was one of those times. The snow was an important part of it, not just the snow, but the fact that it was still snowing, as it is supposed to, but rarely does over Christmas. And the snow was beginning to blanket, as at least it does at first, a multitude of such everyday New York sins as dirt and noise and smells and potholes. Combined with this, the Christmas trees and the lights and decorations inside the windows, all of which can often seem so ordinary in so many other places, seemed in New York that night, with the snow outside, just right. I am not going so far as to say that New York that night was O little town of Bethlehem, but it was at least something different from the kind of New York Christmas best exemplified by a famous Christmas card sent out by a New York garage that year to all its customers. "Merry Christmas from the boys at the garage," that card said. "Second notice." For all that, it was hardly going to be for me a Merry Christmas. I am no Scrooge, but I am a curmudgeon. And the word merry is not in the vocabulary of any self-respecting curmudgeon that you would care to meet on Christmas or any other day. You would be better off with a New York cab driver or even a Yankee fan. There were other reasons why that particular Christmas had little chance to be one of my favorites. The fact that it was after 7 o'clock and that I was still at my desk spoke for itself. The Anti-Cruelty Society, which I had founded a few years before, was suffering growing pains. Frankly, it is still suffering them. But at that particular time, they were close to terminal. We were heavily involved in virtually every field of animal work. And although we were doing so on bare subsistence salaries, or on no salary at all for most of us, the society itself was barely subsisting. It had achieved some successes, but its major accomplishments were still in the future. And so, to put it mildly, as coin of the realm, even its name, the Fund for Animals, had turned out to be a disappointment. I had, in what I had thought of as a moment of high inspiration, chosen it because I was certain that it would, just by its mention, indicate we could use money. The name had, however, turned out not only not to do the job, but to do just the opposite. Everybody thought that we already had the money. Besides the fund's exchequer being low that Christmas Eve, so was my own. My writing career, by which I had supported myself since before you were born, was far from booming. I was spending so much time getting the fund off the ground that I was 4 years behind on a book deadline, and so many months behind on 2 magazine articles that, having run out of all reasonable excuses, one of the things I had meant to do that day was to borrow a line from the late Dorothy Parker and tell the editor I had really tried to finish, but someone had taken the pencil. As for my personal life, that too left something to be desired. Recently divorced, I was living in a small apartment, and although I was hardly a hermit, I had a goodly choice of both office parties and even friends' parties to go to that evening. Still, this was not going to be what Christmas is supposed to be. Christmas is, after all, not a business holiday or a friend's holiday. It is a family holiday. And my family, at that point, consisted of one beloved daughter who lived in Pittsburgh and had a perfectly good family of her own. On top of it all, there was a final irony in the situation. Although I had had animals in my life for as far back as I could remember, and indeed had had them throughout my marriage, and although I was working on animal problems every day of my life, I had not a single creature to call my own. For an animal person, an animal-less home is no home at all. Furthermore, mine, I was sure, was fated to remain that way. I traveled on an average of more than 2 weeks a month and was away from home almost as much as I was there. For me, an animal made even less sense than a wife. You do not, after all, have to walk a wife. I had just turned from the pleasant task of watching the snow outside to the unpleasant one of surveying the bills when the doorbell rang. If there had been anyone else to answer it, I would have told them to say to whoever it was that we already gave at home, but there was no one, so I went myself. The caller was a snow-covered woman whom I recognized as Ruth Dwork. I had known Miss Dwork for many years. A former schoolteacher, she is one of those people who, in every city, make the animal world go round. She is a rescuer and feeder of everything from dogs to pigeons, and is a lifetime soldier in what I have called the Army of the Kind. She is, however, no private soldier in that army. She makes it, too, go round. In fact, I always called her Sergeant Dwork. "Merry Christmas, Sergeant," I said. "What can I do for you?" She was all business.
"Where's Marion?" she asked. "I need her."
Marion Probst, my longtime and longer-suffering assistant, is an experienced rescuer, and I knew Miss Dwork had, by the very look of her, a rescue in progress. "Marion's gone," I told her. "She left about 5:30, saying something about some people having Christmas Eve off." I told her she was a clock watcher, but it didn't do any good. Sergeant Dwork was unamused.
"Well, what about Leah?"
she demanded. Leah Albo is a national coordinator of the Fund for Animals and an extremely expert rescuer. She, however, had left before Marion on, what else, another rescue. Miss Dwork was obviously unhappy about being down to me. "Well," she said, looking me over critically but trying to make the best of a bad bargain, "I need someone with long arms. Get your coat." As I walked up the street with Sergeant Dwork through the snow and biting cold, she explained that she had been trying to rescue a particular stray cat for almost a month, but that she had had no success. She had, she said, tried everything. She had attempted to lure the cat into a have-a-heart trap, but, hungry as he was, and successful as this method had been in countless other cases, it had not worked with this cat. He had simply refused to enter any enclosure that he could not see his way out of. Lately, she confessed, she had abandoned such subtleties for a more direct approach, and although she had managed to get the cat to come close to the rail fence at the end of the alley, and even to take bite-sized chunks of cheese from her outstretched fingers, she had never been able to get him to come quite close enough so that she could catch him. When she tried, he would jump away, and then she had to start all over, the each time ever more difficult task of trying again to win his trust. However, the very night before, Sergeant Dwork informed me, she had come the closest she had ever come to capturing the cat. That time, she said, as he devoured the cheese, he had not jumped away, but had stood just where he was, nearer than he had ever been, but still maddeningly just out of reach. Good as this news was, the bad news was that Miss Dwork now felt that she was operating against a deadline. The cat had been staying in the basement of the apartment building, but the superintendent of the building had now received orders to get rid of it before Christmas or face the consequences. And now the other workers in the building, following their super's orders, had joined in the war against the cat. Miss Dwork herself had seen someone on her very last visit throw something at him and hit him. When we arrived at our destination, there were two alleyways.
"He's in one or the other,"
Sergeant Dwork whispered.
"You take that one. I'll take this one."
She disappeared to my left, and I stood there, hunched in my coat with the snow falling, peering into the shaft of darkness and having, frankly, very little confidence in the whole plan. The alley was a knife cut between two tall buildings filled with dim, dilapidated garbage cans, mounds of snow upon refuse, and a forbidding grate. And then, as I strained my eyes to see where, amongst all this dismal debris, the cat might be hiding, one of the mounds of refuse suddenly moved. It stretched and shivered and turned to regard me. I had found the cat. As I said, that first sight was hardly memorable. He looked less like a real cat than like the ghost of a cat. Indeed,
etched as he was against the whiteness of the snow all around him. He was so thin that he would have looked completely ghost-like had it not been for how pathetically dirty he was. He was so dirty, in fact, that it was impossible even to guess as to what color he might originally have been. When cats, even stray cats, allow themselves to get like that, it is usually a sign that they have given up. This cat, however, had not. He had not even, though, besides being dirty. He was wet, and he was cold, and he was hungry. And on top of everything else, you could tell by the kind of off-kilter way he was standing that his little body was severely hurt. There was something very wrong, either with one of his back legs or perhaps with one of his hips. As for his mouth, that seemed strangely crooked, and he seemed to have a large cut across it. But, as I said, he had not given up. Indeed, difficult as it must have been for him from that off-kilter position, he proceeded, while continuing to stare at me unwaveringly, to lift a front paw, and snow or no snow, to lick it. Then the other front paw. And, when they had been attended to, the cat began the far more difficult feat of hoisting up. Despite whatever it was that was amiss with his hips, first one back paw and then the other, finally, after finishing, he did what seemed to me completely incredible. He performed an all four paw, ears laid back, straight up leap. It looked to me as if he was, of all things, in such a situation, practicing his pounce. An odd image came to mind, something more years ago than I care to remember, that my first college tennis coach had drilled into our team about playing three-set matches. "In the third set," he used to say, "extra effort for ordinary results." We loathed that saying, and we hated even more the fact that he made us, in that third set, just before receiving serve, jump vigorously up and down. He was convinced that this unwanted display would inform our opponents that we were fairly bursting with energy. Whether that was indeed the fact or not, we did the jumping, of course, because we had to. But all of us were also convinced that we were the only players who ever had to do such a silly thing. Now, when I see, without exception, every top tennis player in the world bouncing like cork into the third set, I feel like a pioneer and very much better about the whole thing. And when I saw the cat doing his jumping, I felt better too. But this time, of course, about him. Maybe he was not as badly hurt as at first I had thought. In a moment, I noticed that Sergeant Dwork, moving quietly, had rejoined me.
"Look at his mouth," she whispered. "I told you, they have declared war on him."
Ours was to be a war, too, but one not against, but for the cat. As Sergeant Dwork quietly imparted her battle plan, I had the uneasy feeling that she obviously regarded me as a raw recruit, and also that she was trying to keep my duties simple enough so that even a mere male could perform them. In any case, still whispering, she told me she would approach the fence with the cheese cubes, with which the cat was by now thoroughly familiar, in her outstretched hand, and that, during this period, I apparently should be crouching down behind her, but nonetheless moving forward with her. Then, when she had gotten the cat to come as close as he would, she would step swiftly aside, and I, having already thrust my arms above her through the vertical bars of the fence, was to drop to my knees and grab. The sergeant was convinced that the cat was so hungry that at that crucial moment he would lose enough of his wariness to go for the bait and the bite, which would seal his capture. Slowly, With our eyes focused on our objective, we moved out and went over the top. And just as we did so, indeed, as I was crouching into position behind Sergeant Dwork, I got for the first time a good look at the cat's eyes peering at us. They were the first beautiful thing I ever noticed about him. They were a soft and lovely and radiant green. As Sergeant Dwork went forward, she kept talking reassuredly to the cat, meanwhile, pointedly removing the familiar cheese from her pocket and making sure he would be concentrating on it rather than the large something looming behind her. She did her job so well that we actually reached our battle station at almost the exact moment when the cat, still proceeding toward us, albeit increasingly warily, was close enough to take his first bite from the sergeant's outstretched hand. That first bite, however, offered us no chance of success. In one single, incredibly quick, fluid motion, the cat grabbed the cheese, woofed it down, and sprang back. Our second attempt resulted in exactly the same thing. Again, the leap, the grab, the woof, and the backward scoot. He was simply too adept at the game of eat and run. By this time, I was thoroughly convinced that nothing would come of the sergeant's plan, but I was equally convinced that we had somehow to get that cat. I wanted to get over that fence and go for him. The sergeant, of course, would have none of such foolhardiness, and irritated as this made me, I knew she was right. I could never have caught the cat that way. The sergeant was, however, thinking of something else. Wordlessly, she gave me the sign of how she was going to modify her tactics. This time, she would offer the cat not one, but two cubes of cheese, one in each of her two outstretched hands. But this time, she indicated, although she would push her right hand as far as it would go through the fence, she would keep her left hand well back. She obviously hoped that the cat would this time attempt both bites before the retreat. Once more, we went over the top, literally in my case, because I already had my hands through the fence over the sergeant. And this time, just as she had hoped, the cat not only took the first bite, but also went for that second one. And at just that moment, as he was mid-bite, Sergeant Dwork slid to one side and I dropped to my knees. As my knees hit the ground, my face hit the grate, but I did not even feel it, for in between my hands, my fingers underneath and my thumbs firmly on top, was Cat. I had him. Surprised and furious, he first hissed, then screamed, and finally, spinning right off the ground to midair, raked both my hands with his claws. Again, I felt nothing, because by then I was totally engrossed in a duel performance, not letting go of him, and yet somehow managing to maneuver his skinny, desperately squirming body still in my tight grasp, albeit for that split second, in just one hand, through the narrow apertures of the rail fence. And now his thinness was all important, because skin and bones as he was, I was able to pull him between the bars. Still on my knees, I raised him up and tried to tuck him inside my coat. But in this maneuver, I was either overconfident or under alert, because somewhere between the raising and the tucking, still spitting fire, he got in one final rake of my face and neck. It was a good one. As I struggled to my feet, Sergeant Dwork was clapping her hands in pleasure, but obviously felt the time had now come to rescue me. "Oh," she said. "Oh, dear, your face! Oh, my!" Standing there in the snow, she tried to mop me with her handkerchief. As she did so, I could feel the cat's little heart racing with fear as he struggled to get loose underneath my coat. But it was to no avail. I had him, firmly corralled, and once again with both hands. The sergeant had now finished her mopping and become all sergeant again. "I'll take him now," she said, advancing toward me. Involuntarily, I took a step backwards. "No, no, that's all right," I assured her. "I'll take him to my apartment. The sergeant would have none of this." "Oh, no," she exclaimed. "Why, my apartment is very close."
"So is mine," I replied, moving the cat even farther into the depths of my coat. "Really, it's no trouble at all. And anyway, it'll just be for tonight. Tomorrow we'll decide, what to do with him." Sergeant Dwork looked at me doubtfully as I started to move away.
"Well, then," she said, "I'll call you first thing in the morning."
She waved a mittened hand.
"Merry Christmas," she said.
I wished her the same, but I couldn't wave back. Joe, the doorman at my apartment building, was unhappy about my looks.
"Mr. Amory," he exclaimed, "what happened to your face? Are you all right?"
I told him that not only was I all right, he ought to have seen the other guy. As he took me to the elevator, he was obviously curious about both the apparent fact that I had no hands and also the suspicious bulge inside my coat. Like all good New York City doormen, Joe is the soul of discretion, at least from tenant to tenant, but he has a bump of curiosity which would rival Mount Everest. He is also, however, a good animal man, and he had a good idea that whatever I had, it was something alive. Leaning his head toward my coat, he attempted to reach in.
"Let me pet it," he said.
"No,"
I told him firmly.
"Mustn't touch."
"What is it?" he asked.
"Don't tell anyone," I said. "But it's a saber-toothed tiger. Undeclawed, too."
"Wow," he said. And then, just before the elevator took off, he told me that Marion was already upstairs. I had figured that Marion would be there. My brother and his wife were coming over for a drink before we all went out to a party, and Marion, knowing I would probably be late, had arrived to admit them and hold, so to speak, the fort. I kicked at the apartment door. When Marion opened it, I blurted out the story of Sergeant Dwork and the rescue. She, too, wanted to know what had happened to my face and if I was all right. I tried the same joke I had tried on Joe. But Marion is a hard woman on old jokes. "The only other guy I'm interested in," she said, "is in your coat." I bent down to release my prize, giving him a last hug to let him know that everything was now fine. Neither Marion nor I saw anything. All we saw, before his paws ever hit the ground, was a dirty tan blur, which, crooked hips notwithstanding, literally flew around the apartment, seemingly a couple of feet off the ground, and all the time looking frantically for an exit. In the living room, I had a modest Christmas tree. Granted, it was not a very big tree. He was not, at that time, a very big cat. Granted, too, this tree had a respectable pile of gaily wrapped packages around the base and even an animal figure attached to the top. Granted, even that it was festooned with lights, which at rhythmic intervals flashed on and off. To any cat, however, a tree is a tree, and this tree, praised as he was no exception.
With one bound, he cleared the boxes, flashed up the branches, the lights, and the light cord, and managed somewhere near the top to disappear again.
"Now that's a good cat,"
I heard myself stupidly saying.
"You don't have to be frightened. Nothing bad is going to happen to you here."
Walking toward the tree, I reached for where I thought he would be next, but it was no use. With one bound, he vanished down the far side and, flashing by my flailing arms, tried to climb up the inside of the fireplace. Fortunately, the flue was closed.
thus effectively foiling his attempt at doing a Santa Claus in reverse. When he reappeared, noticeably dirtier than before,
I was waiting for him. "Good boy," I crooned,
trying to sound my most reasonable. But it was no use. He was gone again, this time on a rapid rampage through the bedroom, one which was in fact so rapid that not only was it better heard than seen, but also, during the worst of it, both Marion and I were terrified that he might try to go through the window. When he finally materialized again in the hall, even he looked somewhat discouraged. Maybe, I thought desperately, I could reason with him now. Slowly, I backed into the living room to get a piece of cheese from the hors d'oeuvre tray. This, I was sure, would inform him that he was among friends and that no harm would befall him. Stepping back into the hall, I found Marion looking baffled. "He's gone," she said. "Gone?" I said. "Gone where?" She shook her head, and I suddenly realized that for the first time in some time, there was no noise. There was no scurrying. There was no sound of any kind. There was, in fact, no cat. We waited for a possible reappearance. When none was forthcoming, obviously, we had no alternative but to start a systematic search. It is a comparatively small apartment, and there are, or so Marion and I first believed, relatively few hiding places. We were wrong. For one thing, there was a wall-long bookshelf in the living room, and this we could not overlook. For the cat was so thin and so fast that it was eminently feasible that he found a way to clamber up and wedge himself behind a stack of books on almost any shelf. Book by book, we began opening holes, but he was not there. Indeed, he was not anywhere. We turned out three closets. We moved the bed. We wrestled the sofa away from the wall. We looked under the tables. We canvassed the kitchen. And here, although it is such a small kitchen that it can barely accommodate two normal-sized adults at the same time, we opened every cupboard, shoved back the stove, peered into the microwave, and even poked about in the tiny space under the sink. At that moment, the doorbell rang. Marion and I looked at each other. It had to be my brother and his wife, Mary. My brother is one of the only three men who went into World War II as a private and came out as a colonel in command of a combat division. He was, as a matter of fact, in the amphibious engineers and made some 14 opposed landings against the Japanese. He had also since served as deputy director of the CIA, a man obviously used to crises. He took one look at the disarray of the apartment. In such a situation, my brother doesn't talk. He barks. "Burglars," he barked. "It looks like a thorough job." I explained to him briefly what was going on and that the cat had now disappeared altogether. Not surprisingly, while Mary sat down, my brother immediately assumed command. He demanded to know where we had not looked, only where he couldn't possibly go, I explained, trying to hold my ground.
"I don't want theories," he barked. "Where haven't you looked?"
Lamely, I named the very top shelves of the closet, the inside of the oven, and the dishwasher.
"Right,"
he snapped, and advanced on first the closets, then the oven, and last the dishwasher. And sure enough, at the bottom of the ladder, actually curled around the machinery and wedged into the most impossible place to get to in the entire apartment, was the cat.
"Ha!"
said my brother, attempting to bend down and reach him. I grabbed him from behind. I was not going to have my brother trust his luck with one more opposed landing.
Bravely, I took his place.
I was, after all, more expendable. Actually, the fact was that none of us could get him out, and he was so far down in the machinery, even he couldn't get himself out.
"Do you use it?" my brother demanded.
I shook my head.
"Dismantle it," he barked once more.
Obediently,
I searched for screwdriver, pliers, and hammer. And although I'm not much of a mantler, I consider myself second to no one, not even my brother, as a dismantler. My progress, however, dissatisfied my brother. He brushed me aside and went over the top himself. I made no protest. With the dishwasher, the amphibious engineer was, after all, at least close to being in his element. When my brother had finished the job, all of us, Mary included, peered down at the cat. And for the first time since my sight of him in the alley, he peered back. He was so exhausted that he made no attempt to move, although he was now free to do so. "I would like to make a motion," Marion said quietly. "I move that we leave him right where he is, put out some food and water and a litter pan for him, and leave him be. What he needs now is peace and quiet." The motion carried. We left out 3 bowls of water, of milk, and of food, turned out all the lights, including the Christmas lights, and left him. That night, when I got home, I tiptoed into the apartment. The 3 bowls were just where we had left them, and every one of them was empty. There was, however, no cat, but this time I initiated no search. I simply refilled the dishes and went to bed. With the help of a sergeant, a colonel, and Marion, I now had, for better or for worse, for a few days at least, a Christmas cat. The Literary Cat Cast is dedicated to the preservation of writings with cats as main characters. The purrs that you heard in this episode are from our own Christmas cat, Louis Blue Eyes. We tried to get a few meows from him, but he would only purr. He's our foster, and he will be delivered to his forever home sometime during the holiday season. Louis is about 5 months old. He's creamy tan colored with a red point Siamese look. He was rescued from a feral colony here in Dallas in November and fostered with us to gain weight and nutrition for his emaciated body and to heal from parasites, worms, and much like polar bear, a terrible limp. In fact, he reminds me of polar bear. You may see his photo on this episode page of our website, theliterarycatcast.com. While there, peruse the site for our merchandise and check out the bios of the podcast cats that usually voice our episodes. I wish everyone peace, happiness, and the best life possible. Now wait for the final purrs of Louis. I'm Phoebe Phillips. Thanks for listening.